Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I have a guest coming up a little later this hour. Her name is Alana James, and she's a member of a band that has an awesome name, the Hot Club of Cowtown. It's a Western swing band, and Alana James is like the first full-time musician to tour, female full-time musician to tour with Bob Dylan in like 50 years. So we'll talk with Alana, and the band is really cool, Hot Tub of Cowtown. They're coming to the Blue Strawberry on Friday night. We also have Cut of the Day coming up. I saw this. We've been talking a lot about critical race theory, and I'm familiar with this situation up in northeastern Illinois. It's an area that I know very well because I grew up there until I was 14 years old, Evanston and Skokie School District. I was in the main township school district for a short time up there. Hillary Clinton and Harrison Ford went to my high school, and I only went there for like 3 months, but there you go. Claims to fame. Harrison Ford, Hillary Clinton. But this is an interesting case, and Brandon Busek is with me, the director of litigation for the Southeastern Legal Foundation. Brandon, I'm sorry, I think I called you Brandon. It's Braden, right?
Correct, yes.
I'm sorry about that. I just caught myself at the last moment because I looked at the name. Thank you, Braden, for being understanding of the host mangling your name. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, and don't apologize. It happens all the time. I'm used to federal judges mangling my name, so this is refreshing.
Well, this is a passionate topic for me, and I want to make sure people know enough about critical race theory to be armed with good information. And this deals with some training that teachers were subjected to, doesn't it?
Yes, training for teachers and students. And, it started with making sure the teachers were indoctrinated and then sending them out to indoctrinate students.
So as an example, this was in October of 2020. Superintendent Devin Horton told District 65 teachers, if you're not anti-racist, we can't have you in front of our students. We've made this very clear, Braden. People know this who listen to this show. It's not good enough to be someone who is not racist. You have to be anti-racist. So they forced their employees to accept that white individuals are loud, authoritative, controlling. You have to understand to be less white is to be less racially oppressive. All these things that we've seen with whatever you want to call it. I mean, a lot of the people who don't like it being called critical race theory, even though they know it's critical race theory, want to put a different label on it these days, it seems.
Yeah, and we're not really interested in playing the verbal shell game that is this critical race theory or not. I'd encourage everyone to go to our website at slfliberty.org and just start looking at what this looks like. You can see for yourself. Doesn't matter what the label is, but on it has things like books that you show to students as young as pre-K that have captions in it that say whiteness is a bad deal and it always has been. And then there's a picture of a white devil holding out a contract with whiteness that involves things like stealing land in exchange for your soul. And these are things that are taught in the curriculum consistently throughout K through 12. That's just one example.
So what does the lawsuit say, and what are you trying to do here?
Well, we're trying to get back to what we thought was a well-established principle, and that's equality under the law, especially for school children. We worked very, very hard to overcome a sad legacy of segregation in public schools. I mean, if you think about it, the Supreme Court struck down segregation in schools in 1954. That was 70 years ago. And it was such a serious problem that the National Guard had to go to several states to ensure that schools actually desegregated. And so it's really sad that in 2020, we have school districts where faculty members are separated based on their race.
And it seems like such an obvious point in the law that if you're saying that white people must be treated differently for the color of their skin, that that's racist and illegal. Seems pretty obvious, doesn't it?
It seems like a self-evident proposition. But, you know, there's something about that self-evident truth that all men are created equal that has always rubbed some people the wrong way. I mean, I wouldn't go – I don't want to rank which of American freedoms is the greatest, but that's certainly the one that's the most hard won, right? I mean, you really can't put into numbers the amount of blood that has been shed on the part of Americans to try and really affirm that principle that we are all equal based on race. And so what this lawsuit really hopes to do is to reclaim the Dr. Martin Luther King vision of a colorblind society, so especially in schools.
What, help me out with just the process here and where you file. Don't get into the weeds too much, but what's the hope here as far as what jurisdiction this lands in?
Well, I mean, we know where it is. It's in the Northern District of Illinois, okay, which is, you know, where Chicago is. And that's where the school district is located. So it's there, and we've got a judge, and, you know, the legal process is just beginning to unfold.
So usually in these, if a judge rules in your favor, typically the school district might appeal. But in this case, the same could happen with you. Like if this judge does not rule in your favor, you can take it up and appeal to a different court?
Correct. Right. It goes to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. But, you know, this is a groundbreaking lawsuit. Someone needed to start taking a look at this curriculum and pointing out that it does not correspond with our constitutional vision of equal protection under the law. And this is what the Civil Rights Acts were for. So it's time that courts start taking a look at some of this stuff. This is a dangerous and insidious ideology. And the principle of equality under the law is just too important to allow for any backsliding now.
So, I think that one of the goals would be that you want to land at the Supreme Court eventually. I mean, there's going to have to be an ultimate ruling eventually on this stuff.
Well, I'd rather win and win fast, but sure, if the Supreme Court wants to take it, we're happy to go there.
Would your impression be, and forgive my ignorance of the law, but there probably will be several cases along these lines where suits are filed across the country, depending on circumstances, right?
This is just the first of many cases that Southeastern Legal Foundation is going to begin on this front. It's going to be a wholesale broadside, and we're at the cutting edge. That's Southeastern Legal and Southeastern Legal Foundation, and we need everyone's support.
Give the website out, Braden, for people who want to check out the information here.
Yeah, it's slfliberty.org. That's slfliberty.org. And you can also follow our Twitter. It's @SLF_liberty.
Braden, I appreciate the information. We'll try to keep people as informed as possible. Braden Brusek with the Southeastern Legal Foundation. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. I want to give a few more details from what happened in that particular case in District 65 in Illinois. Everything from teacher reviews to classroom procedures to school lessons is riddled with this language in this particular district. And this is, I mentioned Evanston earlier because Evanston is the school, well, I'm sorry, is the community which has already passed reparations in the form of down payments and housing repairs. So it's a very liberal city council up there, liberal school district. So everything is framed around race and discriminatory language in this particular case. Survey questions for middle schoolers include, this is middle school students, teachers at Nichols Middle School call on you less often than they call on other students because of your race or ethnicity. Teachers at Nichols Middle School discipline you more harshly than other kids because of your race.
These allegations are...
That wasn't supposed to happen. That's the paper hitting the hotkeys again. Because of your race or ethnicity. Teachers grade you harder than they grade other kids because of your race, ethnicity. Teachers at Nichols Middle School think you are less smart than you really are because of your race, ethnicity. These are questions posed to middle schoolers and so on. So then the teachers, and this is where a lot of the CRT has really been predominant, and I think a lot of us would argue that if the teachers are being trained this way, if they're willingly going through these particular training sessions, then this is going to – how can the goal not be that you're trying to have this trickle down to the students? So they have to participate in the Courageous Conversation Program that teaches them to develop their understanding of whiteness and challenge their beliefs about their own association with and relationship to racial privilege and power. District 65 also mandates beyond diversity training. Beyond diversity training. And that segregates people into racial affinity groups. This has been very popular in corporate America. They did something like this at the Pentagon as well, which is what President Trump stopped last year in reverse by executive order. District 65 also has hosted sessions for teachers to read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. We've talked about her book before. Segregating them into reading groups based on race. Providing teachers with personal copies of the book, even announcing that D'Angelo would speak to the District 65 staff in the 2019-2020 school year. I think the pandemic might have blown that up. District 65 instructed schools to select at least one facilitator who identifies as white, as we are centering white racial literacy development. The program that is outlined works to promote an anti-racist and welcoming culture for all students. Look, this stuff is beyond racist. And again, I don't even care if people call it critical race theory anymore. It's just racism and indoctrination. And it needs to be stopped. And if it's going to take a court to do it, then that's fine. Now, this is something people need to be advised of because you're going to hear more and more. This is something that is going viral this afternoon. I don't even know where this teacher is from. It's a liberal teacher. When you hear things along these lines that I'm about to play you, reject them. Because, again, there is no one at least that has given thought to critical race theory, that studied this issue, that wants to stop it. Nobody is trying to keep teachers. Those of you who are teachers are going to lie like this teacher, stop doing it. Nobody is asking you not to teach about Jim Crow. Nobody is asking you not to teach about slavery. Nobody is telling you to not teach anything related to the history of this country. So this is a bunch of lies.
So a response to Republicans, whenever you say we should teach about slavery or the genocide of indigenous people in the classroom, is, oh, well, it happened so long ago. Why do they need to know? Why does anyone need to know? Okay, why do you learn about the Holocaust? Why do you learn about the Rwandan genocide? Why do you learn about imperialism? Why do you learn about the Enlightenment? Why do you learn about the Soviet Union? Why do you learn about the American Revolution? Why do you learn about the Civil War? All those things were in the past. Why do we learn about them? It's almost as though there's a class you take in school where you talk about things that happened in the past. Wait a minute. Wait.
That's funny.
This is all making too much sense, right?
Too much.
No.
She's so funny. Now, either she's the most ignorant history teacher on the planet and she doesn't know what's happening. So this is what I would present to that teacher or to any teacher in my school district, the Rockwood School District, that wants to claim that this stuff isn't happening. Because in this district, and I wanted to be, I was very careful, let me tell you. Last August, when school started for my daughter, kindergarten started, I was the teacher. I was the virtual teacher, okay, for 6 weeks. I saw, like, in the first week of school, some of this stuff, the books, the topics. She's in kindergarten. She's supposed to learn how to read and write. She's not supposed to learn about racism the first day in school. But there it was, the very first day of school. There was a book that they were supposed to, they read it out loud. I was there for the virtual session, which is fine. But the priorities are out of whack. And then you have this situation in, you know, District 65. There were students pre-K through fifth grade that were forced to read aloud this book, and Braden referred to it, Not My Idea, a book about whiteness, Ordinary Terrible Things by Anastasia Higginbotham, which teaches that racism is a white person's problem and we are all caught up in it. That is not history.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Some of the 911 audio being released from what happened in Surfside last week, and it's just devastating. This is a guy who is with an Israeli search team. His name is Golan Vash.
This time, it was between the balconies. Uh-huh. So the balconies, between them, remained a big space of air that we crawled. We crawled in those tunnels. We called the people, and unfortunately, we didn't find anything.
but spaces big enough to crawl into at this point,
yes,
which feels new.
I personally crawled in.
What makes this one so difficult?
The gap between the space, the gap between the layers, between the floors. These tunnels that we found right now were almost the first to be big enough to enable people to stay between them. Most of the collapse is very, very tight. The collapse was major.
Yeah, what I heard him say there, not that it's too tough to translate, is it's basically a pancake situation where there's nothing left except for maybe a few spaces, which does not give you a lot of hope for survivors. Although, it's not impossible. KMOX and KFTK legal analyst Brad Young is with me this afternoon to talk a little bit about some of the lawsuits in this situation. Hello, Brad. How are you?
Mark, doing great.
I think on Friday, and Jane was here as an attorney as well on the roundtable, but there has been at least one suit that's been filed against this condo complex. And the way she was explaining it, sometimes it's important to be first at market. Is that true?
It is true, because eventually there's only going to be a specific pool of money that's going to be available. And literally who gets to the courthouse first is going to help determine how that money is paid out and to whom. And thankfully, and again, this is a tragedy. I don't mean to say thankfully, but it's a tragic situation, and my heart goes out to all of these people who are either we know who are dead or who will eventually be found, because we know that we're just at the tip of the iceberg on this. But from a litigation perspective, Mark, we know exactly how this is going to go, because it's been exactly 40 years ago, 1981, that's when the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Kansas City, the Skywalks, collapsed. 114 people were killed then, 200 others were injured, and we know how that litigation went, and that's really a template for all of these mass collapse situations in terms of litigation.
You know what's amazing to me, Brad, is you're the first person, I'm sure maybe somebody else has mentioned that collapse in Kansas City, which I remember pretty well. I was in high school at the time. But that is very similar, isn't it? I didn't even think about that in reference to this.
Yeah, that's the first thing that came to my mind, because it was a race to the courthouse in that litigation. It took years to work out. But really, since that time, there have been other types of collapse situations, and all of those cases have followed that template that was created in 1981 in Kansas City. I know many of the attorneys who were involved in that litigation. I've heard lots of stories about it, and there's good and there's bad parts, but we kind of know how this is going to move forward.
So, because I think one of the first things is terrible that this is one of our first reactions, but I'll confess it was one of mine last week. And to your point, obviously, the loss of human life and everything that I keep hearing stories of families who, you know, talk to grandma or, you know, mom or dad, and it's just devastating. But one of the things that I said last week, and I'm pretty sure I said it on the air, is that somebody's going to have to write some big checks here, because there's no doubt that there were issues that were not dealt with. But who is going to be targeted here? Is the owner of the condo complex? Is it somebody else? Obviously, the insurance company would be on the hook for the money, but how do you properly target who's responsible?
Well, and that's what these plaintiff lawsuits will be designed to ferret out, is how much insurance do we have and how high can we stack the insurance policies. The primary targets will be the building owner, the association, and the engineers who designed the building and the engineers who certified the ongoing certification of the building. All of the engineers will have something called E&O policies, errors and omissions policies. And those policies are quite large for engineers. So that, I think, is probably going to be the biggest pool of money. Now, the building owner could have some liability, but unless there's evidence that that there's fraud involved, which in this case we've heard some of that already, Mark, that there was some money paid to pay off some inspectors. I mean, again, it's all anecdotal evidence.
Right.
But at that point, you could break through the corporate veil and maybe go to the actual owners themselves, but they're only going to have so much insurance coverage, and that's why I think the biggest pool of money will come from the engineers.
So that's interesting. I wasn't aware of that specific, you know, that specific of an arrangement with insurance when it comes to engineers. But that building was built, speaking of Kansas City, that was built 40 years ago as well. So there's an insurance policy, unless I'm misunderstanding this, Brett, that would still be in place from the engineers that worked back then?
Yeah, there's tails on what's called a tail on a policy, which goes on for a specific period of time depending on the type of policy that the engineers purchase. Because what they do could have decades of impact. I mean, lawyers have to have that. Doctors have to have that. That's why you don't have any OB doctors over in Madison County, because they have to buy what's called tail insurance that carries on for 20 years after the last delivery that they do. So you've got those kinds of tails on policies, and engineers have to have the same thing. In Missouri, in the Hyatt Regency case, the two engineers lost their license. But the real impact of this, and this is what folks need to understand, Mark, is that folks who are seeking justice from this collapse will be very disappointed. There will not be any justice. There will be money paid. Mm-hmm. There will be litigation. But at the end of the day, it's not like someone's going to be hauled out doing a perp walk in handcuffs to be held accountable for this. That's just never going to happen.
But there, I mean, if there were bribes or things along those lines, there could be some criminal culpability somewhere.
Oh, yeah, there could be. Like in the Hyatt Regency case, again, two engineers lost their license. There was allegations in the Hyatt Regency of payoffs. But none of that came to fruition, because when these cases get settled, what happens is that there's the litigation is slapped in terms of confidentiality agreements. We don't know what comes out of those. So if all these cases get settled, we may never truly know what happened.
Well, I want to talk, as I segue into something here, uncomfortably with Brad Young, our KFTK legal analyst, as I don't want to give too much attention to him, but explain what happened with Bill Cosby here today, because he'd been serving a 3 to 10 year prison sentence. All of a sudden, I don't even think anybody saw this coming. Maybe they did because they were familiar with the appeal, but he's out of prison. He's in there for just a couple of years. What was this based on?
Well, I read a story last year that this was going to be the primary argument of his defense team to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and it took a year for them to reach a decision. Here's the bottom line out of all this. And again, it's difficult to discuss because there's no question women were harmed, women were damaged, women were injured because of him. And this decision doesn't change any of that. But it's a very technical reason, and here's what it is. In terms of the person that he was convicted of molesting, Andrea Konstad, the prosecuting attorney in the early 2000s, Bruce Castor, made the decision that there was not enough evidence in his mind to convict Bill Cosby. So he gave Bill Cosby an agreement that says, we will not prosecute you if you will waive your Fifth Amendment right and testify in the civil case filed by Andrea Konstad, which he did.
And then that's where he admitted that he gave her a quaalude and had sex with her.
Spiked her drink. And, he admitted all of those things in a deposition. And I remember at the time talking about it because people said, why would he say that in a deposition? Why didn't he exercise his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination? And he did that because that was waived. In other words, if you waive the right to prosecute someone for a crime, they can no longer assert their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination if incrimination has been taken off the table. And that's what happened in that case. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court simply said because he was given an immunity to prosecution, that he couldn't be prosecuted in this criminal act. And so, therefore, all charges are dismissed, and he's immediately out of prison, and now he's driving back to home today, you know, a free man.
And they also said he can't be charged again, at least not in that case, right?
Right. He can't be charged in that case, and unfortunately, all of these other cases, the statute of limitations has expired on at least all the cases that I'm aware of. So at this point, he doesn't realistically face any more criminal activity.
It's a very interesting situation. So I hadn't even noticed this, but I just checked out one of the stories. The New York Times story has a quote from Felicia Rashad. Those of us who grew up, we know the Cosby Show from the 80s. She was, of course, Bill Cosby's wife in the Cosby Show. She said on Twitter, all caps, finally, and she said, a terrible wrong is being righted. A miscarriage of justice is corrected. So support from his former co-star. She's, by the way, been named the dean of the Howard University's College of Fine Arts. How long is that going to last? They're going to try to cancel her over this. I can almost guarantee it.
Right? Yeah, she will be canceled. In fact, I was checking the Twitterverse today. Lots of outrage over this.
I can imagine. Brad Young, I think you got a show. There's no baseball tonight. The Cardinals actually won a game today. Hold on to your hats for that one. You're on Camo X tonight doing a little talk.
Yep, and filling in for Annie Fry next week.
All right, Brad, we'll see you then for sure. Thank you very much, Brad Young. who is our legal analyst here, 97.1 FM Talk. I'll try to guide you into some interesting music, and this is a band called the Hot Club of Cowtown. It's a Western swing band, which Western swing has kind of become fashionable again, and they're going to be Friday night at Blue Strawberry, which is a great club. Yolana James is with me this afternoon, lead singer, fiddle player, Hot Club of Cowtown. How are you, Yolana?
Thanks, Mark. Hi, I'm great. How are you?
Fantastic. So we got to start with just the name of the band here, because it's a great name, the Hot Club of Cowtown. It's a unique name, but I know there's a reason for it, right? So you have to explain this to us first and foremost.
Sure. Well, the band, you know, we play vintage sort of string music that sort of originated in the 1930s and 40s, and part of our influence is this European band, you know, the quintet of the Hot Club of France, and that's Django Reinhardt on guitar, Stefan Grappelli playing, you know, swing violin. So Hot Club music is a certain style, but we also love American Western music and hoedowns and stuff like that. So when we say Cowtown, it's more like the Cowtown of the imagination. It's not really a place,
yeah,
but it's a state of mind.
I understand completely. So where does this come from in your musical background? We should mention you grew up not too far from here, right on the other side of the state, but on the Kansas side, Kansas City?
Just down the road. Yep. Yeah, I'm from Kansas City. And, you know, I grew up playing classical music. So even though there's, like, of course, a huge, rich, you know, jazz and roots heritage in Kansas City, I didn't really know anything about it the whole time I was living there, I have to confess. But yeah, I grew up playing classical violin, and my mom was in the Kansas City Symphony. And but, you know, I met Whit, like, right after college, and he's just a guitar player who had steeped himself in this style. And I just didn't really know much about it. But as soon as I first started hearing, you know, this kind of, like, crazy dance music from the 1930s, whatever, I immediately realized that it was a perfect, you know, a perfect fit for me. And so we've been doing this for, like, almost 25 years.
Oh, have you really? Because the reason I was going to kind of take you on this path, I know when my son, I have a 21 and 24-year-old, and I remember that years ago, you know, some of the kids, when they were 16, 17, whatever, they were going to a bar here in St. Louis, or a club. It wasn't drinking alcohol or serving alcohol, but it was into, you know, they were doing swing dancing and things like that. It seemed like there was this undercurrent of younger kids sort of getting into this genre or some of the swing. Do I interpret that accurately?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know, waves in the ocean. I feel like over the years, like, sometimes I'll do an interview, it's like, oh, it's not really very popular right now. And then
right.
It's like, oh, it's huge. It's really coming back. So I think it depends who you are, you know, and what you're into. It's really never died out. There are huge, you know, bunches of people, especially on the West Coast, a lot of people in Chicago, like New York City. We always are able to find, you know, dancers and stuff like that, you know, people who are into this, but it just cycles through. It's, I don't know if it's generational or not, but the music is so fantastic. I really don't think it's ever going to be gone. So,
do you know our friend from here in St. Louis, Pokey Lafarge, by any chance?
Yes. Well, we don't know Pokey personally, but I know we have the same agent, and we respect him greatly. Yeah.
Yeah, now I bring him up. Pokey's great. He's a friend. I know him well, and I think he's evolving musically. But, I mean, some of this is tied in with some of the stuff that he does as well, right? So your style of music.
Totally, yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that he does so well is that, you know, even though what he does is this extremely kind of, you know, it's like it's a historic style, but he has completely characterized it as like a modern sort of edgy, contemporary kind of thing. And that really is the key in this kind of music, because it's all about, like, how you describe it and present it. Because all music essentially comes from something else. It comes from something that predated it. So he's a genius and a master, and has done, you know, so much for it just by the way he brings it forth into the world. I mean, of course, he writes a lot of his own stuff. So do we. But, you know, the influence is there. And it's cool that, he hasn't allowed himself to get pinned into some kind of, like, a precious retro, you know, identity. It's so important.
Yeah, I think it's been an active cognizant decision on his part that he did not want to get, you know, pigeonholed into that, which is why that's when I said he's evolving, because I think he's trying to explore some of that. And artists always do that, because you just don't want to be tagged with one style of music. Yolana James is my guest. She's the fiddle player and the lead singer for the Hot Club of Cowtown, coming to St. Louis on Friday. You have toured extensively with a couple of, like, I guess I would describe them as up-and-coming artists, Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. Yolana, is that true?
Yeah, they closed several of our shows.
Do you think they'll be okay? You think they'll make it? I mean, do they have a future, those guys?
Well, we try to set a good example for them when we've been on the road together. I think we've done a good job, you know, giving them some good pointers.
But you have actually, in all seriousness, you became the first female instrumentalist to tour with Mr. Dylan. Is that true?
Well, Scarlett Rivera was in his band on tour in 1970. And I looked around. I mean, he's had women in his band since then. He's had people, you know, singing and stuff like that. But as far as like a dedicated instrumentalist, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure there are people out there who would love to correct me. But as far as I can tell, the only female person in the band on the road playing an instrument between Scarlett Rivera and now was me.
That's awesome.
So I'm like, I'll take it. Yeah.
Yeah. So what that was a ways back though. Was it in the 2000s when you were out with Bob, or you've done that more recently?
Yeah,
also,
you know, we toured with him in 2004. I was in the band in 2005, and then I opened a bunch of shows for him as my own trio in 2006. But like one of the most crushing things that, you know, because of the plague year that's just passed, but we were supposed to go out and do a whole other summer tour with him. We were going to do his whole North American tour with him and Nathaniel Rateliff. And then that whole thing got just, you know, his plate got wiped clean. So that was excruciating. And, hey, I mean, if that's the worst thing that happened to me last year, then I'm doing fantastic, but still it was a bummer because I was just so happy to get to, you know, go back out with all those guys. But all right.
Another Missouri connection there with Nathaniel and Joseph Pope, his bass player from Herman, Missouri. Don't know if you knew that.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. I mean, of course, we never got a chance to meet those guys. Usually on those tours, by the time you're done, it's like everybody's sort of a big, you know, happy group of well-fed.
Yeah, no, I know. No, they, you know, they, Nathaniel, those guys, they sort of based out of Denver, but his roots are right here in Missouri. And I hooked up with them several years ago, right when, you know, when he broke out, and his career path has been just amazing. You know, by the way, and they've played this, there's an amazing, I don't know if you're familiar or have this on your radar. They had to cancel it because of the aforementioned plague year also, but there's a music festival in Columbia called the Roots and Blues Music Festival. You guys would be a great fit for that. Are you familiar?
Oh, no, I don't even think so. We've certainly never played it, no.
It's outstanding. It is in the fall, late September typically. Again, last year didn't take place, but really, really cool music festival. So have the agents check into that one because I think you guys would be you guys would be awesome. So how outside of what you just said about COVID, I'm just so excited, and I think everyone is, to see live music again and be talking about live music, because it's been tough on artists, musicians, and crew members and all the folks that are tied in with what you do.
Yes, it has. It has been tough. I mean, there is a way, though, in which I think for some people, you know, I have been traveling on the road for the better part of every year for, like, you know, 25 years. And so there is a way in which being off the road, you know, being able to be supported in whatever ways, you know, culture has allowed, it really was kind of a peaceful opportunity to kind of reflect and do all the things that you've been trying to get to, you know, for 20 years. So like, I know a lot of musicians in Austin who like have, you know, started an herb garden or, you know, grown tomatoes.
Right.
And just things that like, it's impossible. No, like, you know, traveling professional musician, it's just, you just can't keep it going for, you know, so that's been very sweet, you know, kind of to see people like on Instagram or whatever, sharing their herb garden because they're not going to have a chance to do it again anytime soon. I'm one of those people, you know, so that was really nice. And also just artistically, creatively, kind of letting the bad habits die out and having a chance to focus on and how you want things to be going forward. It's almost like renewing your vows. That's kind of how I thought about it. It's like, you know, you're in this relationship with music itself and your band, and you know, you really have we had a year to say, am I doing this right? Is this the way I want it to be? Is this, you know, how I want to be spending my life? And I think when you see musicians coming back after that, it's like, yeah, you know, I just think it makes it a stronger connection for me personally, I suppose, coming back. It's like I've had a chance to look at it and I decided, yes, it is what I want to be doing. And there's a reason I'm doing it, you know.
Good decision. The Hot Club of Cowtown is coming to St. Louis Friday night at Blue Strawberry. Ilana James, thank you so much for coming on 97.1 FM Talk. Have a great swing through St. Louis.
Thanks, Mark.
Playback ready. Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right, we got to get a cut of the day in here before we wrap up the Wednesday edition of the program. We're going to feature our good friend here from St. Louis, Olympic hammer thrower Gwen Berry, who turned her back on the flag and wore a shirt that said activist athlete over her head. Her explanation now, here's what she says happened. She said it was not supposed to play the anthem when she was on the stage.
Well, originally, we were not even supposed to be on the podium during the singing or the playing of the national anthem. When we were back in the call room, the directions were that we were going to be introduced to the crowd before the anthem was going to be played or after the anthem was going to be played. No one made any mention or any notion that we would be on the podium or had to be on the podium during the singing of the national anthem. I want to make that clear. Those were our directions, either before or after. No other event group that I know of stood on the podium during the playing of the national anthem. However, when we went out to introduce ourselves to the crowd, coincidentally, the national anthem was playing and they asked us to stand on the podium. And then the anthem played. In that moment, I feel like it was a setup because those were not the directions. That was not the intent. The intent was we would be introduced to the crowd either before or after the singing of the national anthem. Mm-hmm. In which if we had that option or if I knew that I was going to be on the podium, I would have chose something else. Mm-hmm.
So that's the story that she's telling right now, but it's a little unusual because clearly she was looking for some attention.
History. If you know your history, you know.
Let me set this up a little better. This is the reason that she's cited for being unhappy with the national anthem and why she takes a stand against the national anthem.
History. If you know your history, you know the full song of the national anthem. The third paragraph speaks to slaves in America, our blood being slain and pilchered all over the floor. Mm-hmm. It's disrespectful and it does not speak for Black Americans. Mm-hmm. It's obvious. There's no question.
Well, there is a question. Historians actually have debated that for a while. It's the third verse that is never sung. She has her interpretation. There are other interpretations. One more cut here.
I never said that I didn't want to go to the Olympic Games. That's why I competed and got third and made the team. I never said that I hated the country. Never said that. All I said was I respect my people enough to not stand or acknowledge something that disrespects them. I love my people, point blank period.
I mentioned this earlier. The follow-up question is, well, do you love this country? Do you love the country that you're supposedly going to represent in the Olympics? Because she said, I love my people. Who are her people? I don't think it's the whole country. That's my interpretation until Gwen Berry sets me straight on that. That's what I heard.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.